Welcome to another installment of Sci-Fi on Screen, a sci-fi podcast dedicated to discussion of science fiction films and TV shows. This is episode 2. I'm going to be talking about The Matrix Reloaded. The Matrix Reloaded was released on May the 7th, 2003. It was filmed concurrently with The Matrix Revolutions. They filmed the sequels together, and then they released The Matrix Reloaded in May of 2003 and Revolutions in, I believe, December. Let's get right into it. Trinity opens the film, again, as in The Matrix. Once again, you follow the green characters as they coalesce. Slowly, eventually, you witness the formation of a clock. The film snaps into sort of realistic time, and you're in. And this film opens with a spectacular opening. Similar to the first Matrix, this is even more so. There's this scene all of a sudden of Trinity on a motorcycle, and you're looking overhead. The camera angle's overhead. She leaps off of some structure, does a backflip, and the motorcycle lands in this some kind of structure. We don't know what's there. Explodes. Then she comes in. And there are some guards that are left in another part of the station. They rush in, and she does her wonderful fighting style again. And again, we see Trinity in action. She's got a new move this time where she jumps completely over a guard and from behind kicks him down. Very similar to the move she had in the original Matrix where we bullet timed when she jumped up and kicked. So far, you know, and we've come from the Matrix, we're ready, man. We're hungry for more Matrix. And the goodwill of the audience at this point in the film is extraordinary. We are ready for anything, and we've just been given a spectacular opening. They're doing the credits the way they did them in the first film. There's continuity. Everyone's excited. I was excited. She's fighting the guards, similar fighting style, similar camera tricks. You know, we're there. And she ends this fight with a brief moment where she pulls out a cell phone and says, "I'm in." Then we shift, and she's falling out in slow motion from a smashed window, firing her twin machine pistols at what looks like an agent to us. Camera cuts to an angle over the agent's shoulder as he runs towards the window she's just fallen out of and turned in midair to fire back. And we're now in bullet time. The camera follows the agent out the window and down. We've seen this effect in a lot of IMAX films where the camera overhead continues over the cliff, you know, and you're following the body down. Very similar effect. So she's falling backwards towards the ground. The agent is falling forwards towards her. They're having a gun battle. Pretty spectacular, if you think about it. Pretty spectacular. Then we watch in slow motion as one of the agent's bullets pierces her body just under her left breast. Her face opens up. We know she's been hit mortally. And all of a sudden, we cut and we wake up. It was all a dream that's been had by Neo. Audience member, I'm sitting there. It's a sequel. It's The Matrix. I'm already dazzled. I'm already excited. What's in store for me? They've given me what I have known to expect from the last movie. I'm excited about it, and I'm ready for more. Now we found ourselves back on the Nebuchadnezzar, piloted by Morpheus, who we've never seen actually pilot the ship before. So he's piloting the ship. We also meet a new operator by the name of Link, who's not yet comfortable with Morpheus's command. A lot of exterior shots of the hovercraft. It looks terrific. Lots more CGI external in this film already. So we know already there's some money on the screen. The lightning of the hover pads looks CGI, but it looks great. We know at this point that, you know what, this is now an A movie. We went from a really economically, you know, shot B movie, which was amazing, but we're in A-land now, and you get a sense of it from these hovercraft shots. It's the first hint, I think, that they're conceiving of the film as a science fiction epic. And as I'll get into, a lot of times that does not always make for a good film. Now we visit Neo and Trinity, their moment of domestic bliss. He's just had that dream. It seems from their discussion that he's having trouble sleeping. From now, he's not telling Trinity the full idea of the dream. He's just saying, you know, I couldn't sleep, and she wants him to talk, and he won't tell her because he's afraid what it might mean. What's also troubling him is he doesn't know what he's supposed to do. So we're not really sure at this point how much time has passed from the first Matrix, but he seems to be waiting from word from the Oracle, who has not made contact, and he's not sure sort of how to go forward. So in the next scene, the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar all jack in, and they meet the crews from several other hovercrafts at some undisclosed location in the Matrix. And once again, we're back with everyone's dressed in leather. Styles are really cool. We've got some other captains now of other hovercrafts. So again, we're expanding in scope. Notably now, we meet Niobe, who is the captain of the Logos, played by Ms. Jada Pinkett Smith, with very similar energy and purpose that Trinity has. So what they're discussing is the Logos has gotten word from another hovercraft called the Osiris that the Sentinels have discovered the location of Zion and they've begun to tunnel down towards Zion from the surface. If anyone here has seen the Animatrix, you'll know that one of the episodes of the Animatrix was the Osiris discovering the Sentinels digging. The Sentinels chasing the Osiris, eventually destroying it, but not before the Osiris gets off a message to the Logos. So we've got a little continuity here. What we find out is there are 250,000 Sentinels that are digging. We hear from the discussion that that's how many human beings there are in Zion. This is it. Everyone is in bad shape. And now Morpheus chimes in and gives his speech about Neo and the One. So we're getting the idea that Morpheus is a full believer in Neo and his powers. He doesn't seem worried at all. He thinks it's all part of the deal and that the Oracle is going to tell Neo what to do and the One is going to perform and do whatever he's got to do and the war is going to be over. In this film, he's been cast as the prophet, in a sense. He is Neo's prophet. And for the first time now, we see other humans who don't really believe what he believes. Of the other captains from that speech, none of them really buy. He's the only one who really believes. The rest of them are very practical. They're not really, you know, they don't really buy into the One. Everyone acknowledges Neo's powers, but as far as saving them and prophecy, nobody's really buying it. So you're getting a sense now that Morpheus is more of a single persona in terms of who he is and what he believes than ever before, because we're seeing him now in comparison with other humans from Zion and other captains. The plot moment is that Nebuchadnezzar's batteries are running down. They still haven't heard from the Oracle, so he asks one of the captains to remain. One of the captains does remain, and the Nebuchadnezzar then heads back to Zion to recharge its batteries. Now, Neo perks up another part of the room where the meeting's taking place, seemingly the lobby where the guards are sitting. There's a knock at the door. We know someone is outside. We see a light on from behind the person, so we can't really see their face, and a package is handed through. The package is for Neo. We can all hear that it's Hugo Weaving's voice. Hugo Weaving simply says, "I have something for him. You see, he set me free," and he leaves. Neo knows something's up because now he's the One and senses things more than most people. So while the meeting is going on, he comes out, talks to the guards. They hand him the package. He opens it up, and it's an earpiece that the agents wear. And the gentleman says, "The guy who gave this to me said you set him free." So immediately he says, agents are coming, the meeting is over. Ostensibly everybody leaves, the door is pounded on from without, and we are into our first fight. Immediately, we have a problem. Neo is the One. He's Superman. He can dive into agents and explode them from inside. How is this going to be even close to fair or have parity? So after the first couple of punches and kicks, there's a break in the fight, and Neo says, as an aside for the audience, upgrades. So we're being told at that point that the agents have now been upgraded to a much stronger, perhaps more powerful models in order to battle Neo. So the fight begins. And immediately I am struck in this moment by how much I'm not in this fight. And it took me a few viewings to figure out why. First, the fight. The agents blast the door in. We have an initial contact between Neo and the first agent. And Neo just looks, it's really well shot. Neo is totally in command of the fight. He looks amazing. Keanu must have been practicing. He's been fighting with the fight coordinator and all the stunt coordinators for so long. He looks amazing, and he's wearing this very cool-looking cassock, which is very broad sort of skirt that comes from his waist. Very cool-looking. Two things happen now. The music starts once the fight begins in earnest, but it's not the Chemical Brothers. It's not any other cool techno band. It's not Rage Against the Machine. It's some kind of backbeat techno done by the soundtrack composer. It sounds, to my mind, it sounded like a 1970s, you know, Streets of San Francisco kind of soundtrack. It was very strange. It was not at all what I remember from The Matrix. The Matrix movie cues were either the really cool, sort of stringy, eerie soundtrack, or they were known bands doing, you know, techno songs. And it made the film terrific. I mean, the music really enhanced the movie. So in the second movie now, it really sounds like filler music. It sounds like fight filler music. So that's how I felt about it. And that's the first thing that threw me off. Second thing is, there's nothing at stake here. Unlike the initial fight with Trinity in the first Matrix, when novelty is driving us, who is this person? Why is she fighting? How can she fight that way? We're all kind of blown away. Plus, she's in danger. Trinity is fighting for her life. And somehow, through film magic, not even knowing who Carrie Ann Moss is in Trinity, we're on her side as she's fleeing from the agents. Neo is totally in control. We're not worried about him at all. And the main problem here is that the fight isn't about anything. Everyone who's come from the other hovercrafts has left the meeting. There's no danger. Neo sent word, the meeting ended, everybody jacked out, no one's left. Neo's there fighting three agents. There's nothing at stake. And they have this nice fight. Somehow, I'm just not into it. I don't know why. You know, I know why now, but I didn't know why then. And then Neo finishes, and for the first time, we see him fly. He bends down in slow motion, and we see the ground sort of ripple as he seems to gather some sort of power from himself. And up and away he goes. After he leaves, Smith arrives, and we see him say, "That went as expected." And the reveal is now he's speaking to another version of himself. Which, okay, I'm in. Cryptic plot. Now there's two Smiths. What's that about? So, okay, a little hit, but we're still in it, right? Now we follow Neo as he flies, and he's hovering over the Oracle's old building, which something else is up. And I can, as the camera closes in on him flying, he looks fake. In fact, he looks animated, which in fact he is. To me, again, every single thing that happens in a film goes into the subatomic process, I like to call this, you know, the subconscious process of an audience's relationship with the film. After a positive start, I think these things are now slowly sifting into the audience and definitely into me. I'm immediately thinking, wow, this really looks fake. In the first Matrix, as crazy as the action was in the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes, something wasn't thrown at me where I said, oh God, that looks terrible or that's fake. Immediately, between the music, the no stakes of the fight, and now Neo's an anime character, I'm taking hits here, and I'm not happy. So Neo goes back to the low-income housing block. He goes to the door where he met the Oracle in the first film, and no one's there. He sees that there are couches there, but it is completely empty. Finally, he jacks out of the Matrix. The next sequence has the Nebuchadnezzar now returning to Zion, and we are introduced to the human city of Zion. We see these massive docking gates. The Nebuchadnezzar comes through some tunnel. The gates are opened, and it eventually pivots and lands. It's a long process, actually, and we never saw this kind of a film style in the first Matrix. Now what we're seeing is what I like to call epic sci-fi ship interludes. Lucas does this a lot. You know, you watch the ship come into the atmosphere, you watch it hover, you watch it land, it looks amazing. As sci-fi geeks, we love that shit, right? That's kind of part of the sci-fi movie deal. Now we really understand that the Matrix franchise has gotten a huge infusion of cash. The Nebuchadnezzar enters, we see humans in these large fighting mechs moving around on the ground. Wait, that's new. We see a huge docking bay with a dome ceiling that would not be out of place in the Star Wars universe. Slowly opens up in like a big camera vista, which, again, we did not see in the first Matrix. It's a really nice scene. The music is soaring. And I couldn't help think that we're out of the Matrix's B-movie roots now, and we've gone grander. But somehow, I wish they hadn't. Because in the grand sequences in this film so far, we've seen this before. I've seen this type of grand staging. I've seen huge vaulted chambers. I've seen big ships dock. It's a bit of a letdown. Even the massive fighting mech that closes the scene, which is really cool. For sci-fi fans, we know about mechs, man. We've seen mechs, and it's kind of cool as a little, you know, a hint tantalizing the how we're going to see them and what's to come. And there was a little thrill, I think, when I saw it the first time. But just the fact that we've had nearly a minute of a ship landing, such a lavish expenditure of a sequence to land a ship, would have never made the cut in the first film. They would have said, you know what, we don't need this. We've got a great story, we've got a great thing going, and we don't need all this fat. The same with the soundtrack. It's gone much more conventional. I hear cues that are not out of place in Lord of the Rings or, you know, Star Wars. Again, I think Star Wars heavily influenced on them for this film. So Nebuchadnezzar lands, and we meet a gentleman by the name of Captain Mifune. Those of you who know, this is a definite allusion to Toshiro Mifune, the great Japanese actor who's played in a lot of Akira Kurosawa films, beloved samurai and Japanese actor. Obviously, the Wachowskis are big into that genre, so that's a direct homage. And he's there with three, basically red shirts. He's there with three meatheads. They're there to escort Morpheus to Commander Locke. We haven't met Commander Locke yet. But again, we're getting the stern anger of the guards. You know, Captain Locke demands. And there's a lot of this kind of arch military language. Captain Locke demands you go to this, and he demands that, and follow me, sir, and all this kind of stuff. And for me personally, like, man, I have heard this kind of stuff. If I hear, you know, stay frosty and all these just pat military lines that I've heard in a thousand other films, like, the Wachowskis, to me, are hipper than that. They're smarter than that. The main guard actor, he's a meathead. He's a really bad actor. His delivery's bad. And we're also in this, everyone's delivery is very arch and stilted. Morpheus's lines are stilted. Mifune's lines are stilted. The guard, everything's very stiff and kind of pompous. It's very flat. Neo asks, and this is again, where I started to get lost in the film. Neo's like, what's between Morpheus and Locke? And Trinity goes, Niobe. Oh, yeah? You know, and she's like, what was it between them? Well, first Niobe was with Morpheus. Now she's with Locke. And we're done. That's the explanation. And we're on to the next scene. So, again, there's something else is happening in this movie that is just odd. It's odd, and it's throwing me. Then we see Neo, Link, and Trinity leaving the Nebuchadnezzar, walking down the gangplank, and this annoyingly enthusiastic character named the Kid, who worships Neo and runs up to him, and he's all excited. And basically, we're getting the sense that, you know, Neo is this really godlike character now. And the Kid, of course, is there to give us the exposition. Everyone's talking. Ships are docked, you know. And eventually, you know, we also see that Neo's walking back to his quarters, and there's a huge group of people there with things for Neo to touch. And, oh, Neo, bless my son. Neo, my son is sick. And Trinity leaves him. Says, there's still time. And that's a cool, kind of a cool scene, because that speaks to something kind of real about that sort of thing. So I kind of got that. But during this whole scene, the whole time that they're walking and he's talking to the Kid, there's multiple shots from the back, and Neo has no neck hole. He's no neck hole. Trinity has a neck hole. Neo has no neck hole. The neck holes were left in all of them. That's how they jack into the Matrix. So again, as a viewer, I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? These guys who were so, were giving me shots in the rearview mirror of motorcycles and of characters' glasses, now they're leaving out major continuity set pieces. It's just, I'm not happy. As a viewer, someone who's really, really come to love this universe that these guys have created and really respect the hell out of them, these things are starting to pile up on each other. And then the next scene is Morpheus and Locke, and it's just two jackasses talking military jackasses at each other. Like, you know, you disobeyed a direct order, blah, blah, blah. You did this and you did that. The scene doesn't do anything. It really doesn't do anything. It doesn't move anything. Most of the things that are going to happen are going to be dealt with in the next few scenes. So these are just two guys barking at each other. And in comes a longtime character actor, Anthony Zerb, who is a counselor, and he's there, and he's actually the best thing in the Zion sequences. He's like, a real actor is here. And he's somehow able to, you know, make something out of these very arch and very formal lines. But it's a really bad scene. It's just a really bad scene. And I don't know really what the purpose of it was. So now we're getting into Zion proper, and we get our first true epic shot of Zion. And it is a cylindrical city, sort of a cylinder, a vertical cylinder, that's crisscrossed with these walkways. Very cool design. I enjoyed it. I think it was really, really nice. All seemingly maintained by these massive machines that pump air into it. Then we have a scene where Link returns home, and we get a sense that Link is with Dozer's sister, Z. She's lost her two brothers. Basically, the scene is grounding. It's basically Link's little side story where she's angry that Link is the operator for the Nebuchadnezzar. She doesn't want him to leave Zion. It's not safe. He's doing it as a promise he made. So he said, and you get a sense that off screen, Dozer had said, you know, if anything happens to me, you got to be operator on the ship. You know, they're a little bit at odds, and you get this moment where she wants him to wear this little pendant. It's okay. You know, it sets up the will Link get home safe subplot that kind of feeds into Revolutions. But like everything else we've been seeing since coming back to Zion, it just kind of feels a little padded. It feels a little, the scene is kind of very, it's played very naturalistic, but it just feels strange in this film. And again, nothing like the lean and mean films of the first film. I mean, whether this is something that all sequels have to deal with and I'm just, you know, being a dick, I can't rule on, you know. But what I'm trying to get at here is what is happening to me as I'm watching this film, and not to be a crank about it and be like, oh, this is terrible, but how I'm processing the things that are coming up on screen versus how I processed things that came up on screen in the first film. That's kind of all I'm trying to do. However, things keep getting difficult because now Morpheus makes a huge speech. Zion gathers in this underground cave. They're all dressed in kind of ragged clothing, which is fine. And Morpheus is now going to make this speech to tell them all about the sentinels that are coming. There's a moment right at the beginning where Morpheus screams, "Zion, hear me." And it is a terrible line. He looks overweight and kind of goofy. And the speech is done in a very strange, halting tone. I just found it a very cliched, stock, getting the troops ready speech, and Morpheus making a speech like a military leader. This is a new movie we're watching. And to me, I don't find the transition. It was so cool in the first movie, and now Morpheus is being asked to do this very cliched cinematic thing, which is to give this huge speech to the, you know, assembled. At the conclusion of his speech, there's this huge rave. And you're back in the Wachowskis' nightclub scene, and people are arriving, and the music is the drums that started off. It kind of morphs into techno music, and I get it. You know, they're starting on the theme of like humans doing what humans do best. The notion, you know, they're starting to split now their theme in terms of humans and machines possibly coexisting, which doesn't come until a little bit later. But they're planting the seed of like, this is what humans do, and say what you want about it, it's there for a reason. Intercut with this rave is Neo and Trinity making love. I did not buy the scene at all. It seemed very awkward to me. Don't know what to make of it. It was a very strange scene. I watched it. I understood that we want to see these two together, but it kind of left me in a very strange place. Then we quick cut to a scene of some of the guys who stayed behind to get the Oracle's message are in the Matrix. They jump down and they're about to jack out, and one guy's got a message. It is from the Oracle. He jacks out safely. They talk about, what was that one agent? I've never seen that before. And before this guy can, the other guy can jack out, Smith drops in and he jams his hand into the guy's chest. And you see this bizarre sort of process where things are viraling out from his hand. They ripple over this guy's body. And when they finally coalesce and it's finished, another Smith is made. So you've seen how he copies himself. And then the cool, you know, one of the first cool ideas in this film is that Smith has copied himself over the consciousness of a human being. He's overwritten the human being's brainwaves, and he is now there. And when the phone rings, both Smiths look at each other, and the Smith who has just been copied picks up the phone and jacks out. Very neat idea. Next we cut to, it's late evening, the rave is finished. And Neo comes out, and he and the counselor meet. Counselor takes him down to sort of the engineering level because he likes to walk there at night. And this is the first, the sequels are very much set up where the Wachowskis decided to deal with certain philosophical concepts. And they deal with the concepts one after the other. What happens is usually there's some discussion by the two characters of the concept itself. You're going to get that later with the Merovingian as well. So this is the first one. The concept is about control. It's also about interdependence with machines. So they have this discussion, and it's a great discussion. What is control? And Neo saying, well, if we wanted to, we can shut off these machines. The counselor says, yeah, we could, but then, you know, how would we get our heir and all our power? And Neo recognizes that what the counselor is beginning to intimate is that the future might contain both machines and men, and that the war is tricky. And I think this is the counselor struggling with his faith. He's struggling to understand Neo's powers. There's no question that he has the powers that no one can really understand. The counselor doesn't know what it means. And what he wishes to know is what his powers mean for the human race in terms of them making decisions about what to do. Suddenly, notices get gotten from the Oracle, from the ship that we had seen earlier. We have a brief scene between Link and Z. Z gives Link this pendant, and there's a, please don't get killed, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we meet this strange character named Bane. You know, we've never met him before. We don't know what he's doing. He sees Neo coming down sort of one of the tunnels. He has a knife behind him, and he looks really strange. He's been cutting himself. And the camera sort of follows Bane as Bane's following Neo. And at some point, Bane runs into someone who he knows, and, hey, Bane, what are you doing? And he puts the knife behind his back. And then there's this cryptic statement because he realizes he misses his chance. He says, we'll see you, and Bane fades off. And he had a really strange cadence, and, you know, some people are already understanding that, you know, the copy of now in Bane's head. Very cool idea. Neo's little buddy, the kid, runs up and says, hey, one of the kids wanted you to have this, said you'd understand, and hands him a spoon. And, of course, we know it's probably from the English kid in the first Matrix who had that great discussion with Neo about, you know, there is no spoon as he was waiting for the Oracle. Then there's a kind of lock-jawed scene between Locke and Hammond. And Locke's like, why are you sending Morpheus away with the Nebuchadnezzar? I need every ship I got. And Hammond says, well, we don't believe so. And it's just a lot of guys yelling at each other. And, again, it's just, by this time, I really, really had lost a lot of faith in this film. Then we're back in the Matrix, and there's this incredible Asian metropolis. Wonderful art direction. Like, we're back, man. Like, in one shot, we're back in the Matrix. And it's almost, it's the coolest Matrix neighborhood we've ever seen. It's sort of this Blade Runner-ish Asian neighborhood. And you're really like, oh, man, this is really cool, right? And then Neo enters into a little, what looks like the inside of an Asian tea house. If you're a martial arts fan, you've seen in hundreds of martial arts movies. And there's a really cool looking Asian dude in kind of a Asian martial arts sort of looking outfit. And he proceeds to fight with Neo. The fight takes place on top of a table. There's a lot of chopsticks flying around. A very uninteresting fight. No one's really landing blows. Nothing seems to have any power behind it. It's very dance-like and very anticipatory. You really get the sense that both guys know exactly what punches are going to be thrown and what kicks are going to be thrown. And we don't really know why they're fighting until Seraph, who is the character, stops the fight. Since he's the guardian of the Oracle, he had to know that Neo is who he was. And there's a nice funny line where Neo's like, you could have asked. We get our first really cool line from this film, and he says, you never really know someone unless you fight them. We're back, partially. We're like, okay, man, we're back in style here. And also, the music is an improvement. It's Asian. It's the Asian kind of taiko drumming that they do throughout the whole fight, and it's really great. It's very organic, very earthy. So although the fight wasn't great, music was good, line was good, it was brief enough, it had that wonderfully cool feel that we got so used to in the first film. Next, we go to our second really cool moment where we get a visualization of what it might be to have access to sort of backdoors in programs, if you were a programmer. Seraph takes Neo through a door, and then all we see is a long hallway filled with doors. And Neo says under his breath, oh, these are backdoors. And Seraph has keys with him, so they walk down the hall a bit, and then Seraph opens another door. They're into a whole new scene. Now we're in like an urban park. And the whole concept is great. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, fantastic. We're back in, you know, Dazzleland. Now they're in this whole thing about back doors, and we're seeing another level of the Matrix, like a more powerful or more expansive level of the Matrix. So now we have a scene between Neo and the lovely Gloria Leonard once again. And she's wonderful as usual. Lights up the screen. There's an earthiness, an incredible vitality coming out of her. She just owns the screen. We get a lot of information in this scene. First is that the Oracle and Seraph are actually programs from the machine world. And that's a biggie. What Neo recognizes is, you know, right away, like, how can I trust you? And the Oracle says, That's a pickle. But what she's saying is that, you know, she actually wants peace between humans and machines. You know, that's kind of part of her deal. We also hear about some other things. In basically information we're getting here, and we get this information because it's sort of, you know, how Smith has come to be, is what she says is a lot of times programs in the Matrix, when they become outdated or defunct, are targeted for deletion. They're supposed to return to the machine mainframe back to the source where they're deleted. But sometimes the programs go rogue. And when that happens, Neo says, well, I've never heard of anything like that. And she says, every time you've heard someone saw an angel or a ghost or a werewolf, any legend of aliens or vampires, these are programs that have malfunctioned, doing things that they shouldn't be doing. The agents obviously get to them at some point to delete them. So again, this is very much foreshadowing because it's exactly what's happened to Smith. When Neo and Smith met at the end of the first Matrix, something happened to Smith. He malfunctioned. He did not return. And he'll even say that in his little speech, which is coming up very quickly. But it's nice, you know, in terms of the story, it's a very much a foreshadowing of the creation of Smith. The little byplay jokes between them that, you know, she's always asking him, do you want candy? Do you want to sit down? He hesitates, well, you already know I'm going to do that. Like, none of that, I don't think any of that works. It's cute, and it's the little telltale theme between Neo and the Oracle, and I get why it's there, but it didn't work for me. So near the end of that, we basically get Neo's marching orders. His path as the One ends at something called the Source, which is the machine mainframe. However, she says, you must get the Keymaker in order to get a key to the door that leads to the Source. She gives him something, says you have to go find a program called the Merovingian and be at that location at that exact instant, and you'll have a chance to get this Keymaker. She also tells him that he has something called the Sight now. What she tells him is sort of, and you're getting the allusion to the dream about Trinity's death, is that, you know, he's already made his choice, and now he has to understand that choice. And he's pushing back, saying, no, I can't, I won't. Because he thinks she's saying, you've already made a choice to let her die. And he's like, no, I won't make that choice. And she's saying, we can't see past the choices we don't understand. After many viewings, I now kind of understand what she's talking about. And as she's talking to him, he doesn't understand that, again, he's sort of in something larger than his perception. What will turn out to be the hoax of the One and the prophecy and all that crap is something he's going to have to, it'll be the second level that he steps outside of. But he hasn't yet. And she knows this. I don't think she can tell him because, in a sense, she's also part of that whole set of rules and set of issues. And it's not her place to choose what happens when he gets back there. That's a first-time viewers, man. There's no way you're getting this. But further viewings, one of the things in the sequels that I think is tremendous are the thematic implications. I get very frustrated with the films on a dozen levels, but one thing that I truly respect is the thematic thinking that the Wachowskis have gone through. When they've really thought these films out in terms of playing with certain themes. They've also really done a hell of a job on the script in certain areas in making these things really cool things in terms of the plot. I'll say that. Sad little coda here, when Gloria Leonard leaves with Seraph, it's the last we ever see of Gloria Leonard. Actually, she died during the filming of both these films. And what you will get in The Matrix Revolutions is the same character as the Oracle, however played by a different actress. And I think they were very clever in describing exactly why that took place. And I'll get to that when I do Revolutions. Smith and Neo. Once again, you know, their second battle. This is now philosophical issue number 2. We're dealing with the word purpose. Smith goes into this whole explanation about purpose. Purpose drives us. Purpose defines us. Purpose in this and purpose in that. And he explains that something happened to him and that Neo freed him. He knew he was supposed to go back to the source to be deleted, but he was compelled to stay, compelled to sort of disobey the machine mainframe and to remain. You know, something is different about him. He has extra powers now. He is at least as strong as Neo in some ways. One-on-one, he's still not a match. And he tries to pull his little copy trick on Neo, but it doesn't work. Somehow Neo fights him and it goes back. I think this scene is here to show the level of Smith's new powers, right? If you've read about this in blogs or in magazines, it's called the Burly Brawl. And by the end of this fight, Neo is fighting 100 Smiths. And it continues to escalate. I have a lot of problems with this fight. The first problem is, again, there are no stakes. Yes, there are stakes in a sense, but the Oracle is gone. There's no danger. It's only Neo and Smith. And somehow, I'm not afraid for Neo's life because it's the middle of the movie. I know Neo's not going to die in the middle of the second Matrix. And I mean, I'm sorry, man, but that's part of the amount of information when I'm watching a film that I comprehend. I know Neo's not going to die, and I know nothing terrible is going to happen to him right now, that will come later. And the Oracle is gone, and there's no other humans around, and he's in no danger. He's fighting 100 Smiths, and I don't care. I do not care. It's a shame. We're getting, and to me, I don't like at all. I don't like the soundtrack cues. They sound very amateurish, very 1970s. And we get a lot of anime Neo as well when he does these incredible tricks to fight off 100 Smiths. There's a lot of shots of him that are, it's animated and you can't help it. I am uninvolved in the fight. The fight is shapeless. It doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end. It simply has Neo fighting Smiths, more Smiths, and more Smiths, and more Smiths, and more Smiths. And eventually, he knows there's too many, and he flies away, and he leaves. There's one opening shot when Anderson enters the scene in slow-mo. Some crows fly out of the way, and it's a very cool scene. But it's very similar to the first fight in the film, where there just doesn't seem to be anything at stake. So we cut back to Zion. There's a big gathering. All of the hovercraft pilots and crew are gathered, as well as a bunch of other people. And we have the ruling council of Zion is there. And they're basically asking if anything has been heard from the Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, Commander Locke is the leader here, so he's the one answering most of the time. And poor Harry Lennox. He doesn't have much to say. I don't know whether to say poor Harry Lennox or say Harry Lennox should have been thrown off this movie. He's just very, very stiff, very arch, very military. And the basic idea here is that the council is more and more concerned now. They realize that they can't win. Locke basically is convinced that with every possible ship that he can fight and they can win, they can do this. And you get the sense the council's coming around to helping Neo as much as possible. So they call for volunteers for two ships to be sent to find out what's going on with Neo and the Nebuchadnezzar. There's one volunteer. And then, of course, Niobe volunteers, and Locke is pissed off, and Locke walks up to her, and it's just this dialogue that I don't understand. And when I say I don't understand, it's not that I don't understand the meaning of the dialogue. I don't understand the delivery. Locke says, "Damn it, Niobe, you know, why are you doing this?" And Niobe's answer is, "Because some things stay the same, Jason, and some things change. Cut, you're done." I don't know what this is. I guess they're experimenting with elemental dialogue. Like, can we make each piece of dialogue be this elemental pivotal line that explains everything, or to make every line cryptic? It's an odd choice. I don't like it. And again, it takes me out of the movie, as so many things are doing now with this movie. We're back to Morpheus, Neo, and Trinity, back in the Matrix in their leather clothes, and they're going to visit this program we've heard the Oracle talk about called the Merovingian. And the Merovingian, you know, like most bad guys in most movies, operates a nightclub. And he is in his nightclub. They go in, and the Merovingian is played by Lambert Wilson, who, Lambert Wilson is a French actor. He has a real French accent. And he's really hamming up the part, and he's really fantastic. So the Merovingian is this program. He's sitting behind this table in this nightclub restaurant. And now we're on to another philosophical idea. I think this is like the third one. I think the first one was with Neo and the counselor in Zion talking about control and the machines. Second philosophical idea was purpose, which is Smith explains purpose supposedly of that fight. Now the Merovingian is introducing us to causality. Basically, they come to ask for the Keymaker, and the Merovingian says, "This is not a why." He's asking, you know, "Why do you want the Keymaker? Why are you here?" And he's basically saying, "You're here because somebody told you to come here. That is not power." It's a cool idea that they're playing around with. He's like, you know, "You have no idea why you're here." And of course, if we've seen all the movies, we understand that the Merovingian is correct. They have no idea why they're there. They think they're there because they're going to find the Keymaker, go to the source, and save the world and stop the war. And the Merovingian recognizes that, and this is prior to Neo understanding what he understands about this Chosen One mythos, that they're just playing out another scenario, that the Oracle is there telling them to do certain things, and it's all part of a scenario, and the Merovingian is outside that scenario, and he knows that Neo and Trinity and Morpheus are not. So his whole notion of causality is, he says, look at this woman over there, look at her. And it's very funny, so bourgeois, so obvious. Eh? But he writes a piece of software, which is a slice of cheesecake, which will cause orgasm. And we watch a woman slice into the cake, and the Merovingian is narrating now what she is feeling as she's eating the cake and how she's coming to orgasm. And when the climax, ha-ha, of the little scene, is her having an orgasm, and the Merovingian telling us that the key to this is that she has no idea how that orgasm, that she was completely overwhelmed, completely out of control, and she has no idea why. And this is the Merovingian's point, is causality. And it's a really terrific philosophical point. What he's getting at, and again, what I think the sequels do really well, is they play around with these ideas and themes in a really, really elevated and complex way. I don't think the films are worthy of the ideas at the end of the day in terms of execution, character, and dialogue and drama, but the ideas themselves are fantastic. And for them to even attempt to do what they're doing, I think, is pretty cool. The notion of causality, cause and effect. And he's doing this in front of Neo, knowing Neo, he's really playing with Neo, because he knows Neo right now is a prisoner of cause and effect, because he doesn't understand the things he's doing. He's just doing what he's been told to do. He's the chosen one. He's been told that. He's actually become the chosen one. That's real knowledge. And yet, even within that chosen one apotheosis for Neo, it's still inside of a bubble in which he cannot see outside of. And the Merovingian is hinting at this. So briefly, Merovingian says, look, you're here. You have nothing I want. I have the Keymaker. I see no reason to give him up. The answer is no. Goodbye. So they leave. They're in the elevator, Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus. And they're, well, did we do everything right? I don't know. Maybe it's something we didn't do. Maybe we're wrong. The door's open. They're not out yet. And it's Persephone. And she says, if you still want the Keymaker, follow me. They follow Persephone into the bathroom. And Persephone propositions them and says, I will give you the Keymaker, but first Neo has to kiss me. And Neo has to kiss me like he was kissing Trinity. And she makes this very explicit. You need to kiss me the way you would kiss her. I want to feel what that's like. It's been a long time. Trinity balks. Neo finally says, fine. They have the first kiss. Neo basically mails it in. She knows he's mailing it in. She says, no, the deal's off. Neo says, wait, okay. So he leans in, gives her the full Megillah, and, you know, they have this moment of Persephone where she realizes how in love they are with each other, and she steps up to Trinity and she says, I envy you, but such a thing is not meant to last. Obviously, seeing the trilogy, it's true. You know, that it is not meant to last. They go into a room where there are two guards, but she kills them both with silver bullets, saying something about an older version of the Matrix. We don't know what that means. First time viewing, we're not an older version of the Matrix. But again, it's the werewolf motif that the Oracle had spoken about. So obviously, those were two old programs that had not gone back to the source. Then we're back in old Hollywood, behind a bookcase is a secret door, and we're in sort of, all of a sudden, it's Carol Reed and the Third Man. We're in these sewers. We finally get to the Keymaker, and the Keymaker is in this incredible room. The art direction in this room is amazing, very much like the Asian cityscape that we saw when Neo was coming to see the Oracle. Incredibly rich, detailed scene. Just thousands upon thousands of keys in this little hole, and the Keymaker is making a key. So they get the Keymaker, and they're about to leave, and of course, when Persephone had killed one of the werewolves, she left one alive. She said, you can die right here now, or run and tell my husband what I have done. So as they're leaving with the Keymaker, the Merovingian arrives with his henchmen, and there is some dialogue between her and the Merovingian, and we're meant to believe that Persephone is just this jealous, bored lover who wanted to fuck around with her lover. The byplay between the two of them, to me, seems just very juvenile and very childish. Perhaps it was meant to be so. There's this throwaway line before the fighting starts, right? Something about your predecessors when he's talking to Neo, and again, we don't know what that means. What do you mean, your predecessors? He's the one. As a viewer, you're thrown by it, but not for very long. So Morpheus and Trinity and the Keymaker run. Neo stays and fights the big battle where it's him versus like 10 guys. There are these twins. They look like albino twins. They were actors in real life. They're brothers. Really cool. They're these sort of programs that can morph and melt into walls and into floors and become sort of incorporeal. for a brief time. And they have some very cheeky dialogue. They have English accents. And they're actually the first two new cool kind of villains that we see in this film that we really like. Now, we're into a big set-piece fight. There's a large room with these two staircases rising to the top. So we've got a balcony and a below area. And the walls themselves are completely festooned with weapons, all kinds of martial arts weapons. And it's a very long fight. But again, the music kicks in, and it's the same music cue that's happening in a lot of these fights where it seems very 1970s to me. There's something about it that just does not lend the fight any sense of urgency. And this fight, again, the Keymaker and Neo and Morpheus, they're gone. So Neo is fighting these guys. And, you know, once the Keymaker and Morpheus and Neo leave the area and go through one of the doors, they pretty much got away. So Neo is just there fighting for an extended period of time. And for me, watching this, I don't think there are no stakes for me. It's the middle of the movie. You know, I know Neo's going to win. There don't seem to be any stakes to the fight. I don't feel a dramatic urgency in this fight. I'm just sitting there eating my popcorn and sort of very detached watching this martial arts spectacle. I don't think as a filmmaker or a writer that you ever want your audience to be detached and sitting back and just sort of popcorning it. Even though you're making a popcorn film or you're making an action film, I think at the end of the day, you want the audience to care very much about the characters that they're seeing. You want the audience to be afraid when the characters are in jeopardy or fighting. And again, this is not the case with this Neo fight. And there are a lot of cool shots. There are a lot of really neat bullet time shots. There's these great large shots from either medium shots or longer shots. You see guys jumping up from high places, hitting down, jumping back up again in slow motion. And it looks beautiful. But to me, I found it to be a very empty spectacle. And again, I thought at any time, Neo just has to fly away. You know, he's not in any danger. None of these guys are going to kill him. The other chase is actually a lot more fun. You have Morpheus and Trinity and the Keymaker trying to escape from the twins. And there's this fight where, you know, they jump in a car and, you know, they're on their way. The twin is standing there and the twin sort of dematerializes and with a razor swipes at the Keymaker, but of course it's incorporeal, so the car keeps going. And part of these two ghost characters, part of their powers, make the early part of what is now a very, very long car chase. Basically, the entire second act of this movie is one long car chase. And at one point, an agent actually gets in the back of the car and they have this fight. And, you know, there are certain martial arts fights where the combatants are constrained by where they are. So, they're sort of fighting where someone's in the front seat, someone's in the back, or two people are constrained in a seat next to each other. And the fight's got quasi-comical because they can only move certain parts of themselves. And this works really well. But I have to say, overall, first of all, my pet peeve, I hate car chases. When I know I'm in for a car chase, I'm basically going to take a leak. I'm getting some popcorn. I am not a fan of car chases. I mean, other than the French Connection, I have never really seen a car chase that has made me interested, where I was gripped by it, where, you know, it's a car chase, man. It's 2014, and now we're in a very long car chase. In brief, they get on. Morpheus asks Link for an exit. He wants to get to the freeway. We hear some byplay between the characters, you know, where Trinity's saying, the freeway? Freeway? You always told me never get on the freeway, that it's a one-way trip. And Morpheus is like, well, I hope at this one time, Trinity, I am wrong. So they get on the freeway. There are now agents chasing them, and these two ghost characters who work from the Merovingian are also chasing them on this freeway. It's a freeway chase scene. There are cars, there's a huge pileup, there are cars that flip over, things are spectacular, and I am not involved in any of it. I'm not interested. It goes on for so long. The last part of it, Morpheus is standing on top of a tractor trailer fighting an agent and doing pretty well. And as we remember, these are upgraded agents, and that Morpheus is holding his own against upgraded agents, something that I just don't understand as a viewer. Even if I don't consciously go there while I'm watching the film, there's something wrong with it. And unconsciously, there's something about it that's kind of wrong. And again, it's the sum total of over and over again, small tweaks and decisions that are made by the filmmakers that's pushing me out of the film more and more and more. It's not, you know, in a way, it's not huge things that are pushing me out of the film, but it's the agglomeration of small things that are slowly more and more just pushing me out and just keeping me really, really far away and having me just sit back and watch the spectacle unfold, caring less and less and less as I'm watching. I will say, throughout all this, there is one really cool scene where Morpheus pulls a samurai sword and a SUV full of agents is coming right at him. He sidesteps, swipes with the samurai sword through the side of the car, and part of it pops off the gas tank, punctures a hole in the gas line. As a result of that, the SUV, when it passes Morpheus, they turn and the SUV sort of flips. But as it's flipping away from Morpheus. So what Morpheus is seeing is the underside of the car. As the SUV flips, Morpheus pulls out his machine pistol and throws dozens of rounds into the gas tank, and the thing blows up. One of the coolest scenes that I've ever seen in terms of action. Just man with samurai versus car with guns. And it's great. But again, it cannot save the sequence of just continually escalating, mind-numbingly repetitive action sequence upon action sequence upon action sequence. And at the climax of the sequence, the agents are running two tractor trailers towards each other. And just as they smash into each other, the Keymaker and Morpheus jump. The tractor trailers explode, and Neo is flying past them and picks them both up. And this is all done in bullet time. And it's cool. It looks really cool. It's a very impressive action shot. In terms of on paper, if you just say in terms of an action movie or an action shot, it's very impressive. It's a very cool shot, and it's something that it's fun to look at. But again, it's fun to look at, but I'm out of the movie at this point. I'm really, really out of the movie, waiting for something to come up and grab me again. So this monster action sequence is finally finished. They have the Keymaker. They're done. We cut to a shot for the first time, a really big scale shot of the Sentinels and these massive digging machines that they're using to tunnel down to Zion. It's a great shot. Scale is really impressive. We get a sense of what our heroes are facing. And then we have the discussion between Morpheus, the Keymaker, the two captains of the other two ships. So there are three ships. Keymaker says, in order to get to the source, there is a building that's, you know, completely wired with explosives. There is a certain floor in this building that they have to enter via the Keymaster's keys. And once they open that door, enter into that hallway, they now have a very certain amount of time to open another door to get into the source. So what must happen is, in the Matrix, one of the teams from one of the hovercraft has to destroy a power station. They have to destroy the station before the Keymaker, Morpheus, and Neo enter into the sort of backdoor corridor, which we've seen before with Seraph and the Oracle. The other team has to take up a backup power station, because once they enter into that place full of doorways, that backdoor hallway, there's a certain period of time where they have to travel to find the door to the source. And once they open that door to the source, power must still be off. And if the backup power station isn't taken out by then, when they open that door to try to get to the source, the entire floor will blow up, killing everyone. So the plan is, the crew from the Logos, which is Jada Pinkett Smith's crew, are going to jack into the Matrix and blow up the primary power system, which is going to knock down a certain amount of power grids in the city. And then the crew from the Vigilant, which is the other ship that came out to search for them, is going to blow up the backup station. They start the mission. The Logos crew takes care of the main power station. The Keymaker and Morpheus and Neo actually go into the backdoor hallway. But then Trinity and Link realize that something terrible has happened to the Vigilant, that they have been destroyed, and their mission failed, basically. They were found by Sentinels, totally destroyed. So now Trinity realizes that Neo's going to die unless something is done. Now, going back earlier, because of Neo's dreams, before the mission started, Neo took Trinity into a room and he said, listen, I'm going to ask you to do something, but I'm afraid of what you're going to say. And what he asks her is to, under no circumstances, go into the Matrix. Obviously, he thinks if she stays out of the Matrix, whatever he is seeing as his vision will not come true. So now she's faced with this moment where she knows he's going to die, so she's got to go into the Matrix. And so now we're back to the very beginning of the film, the opening scene. Now it has context. Now we understand why she blew up the power station and why she faced all those agents and what happened. And she does destroy the backup power station. So when Neo finally gets to the door, to the Oracle, everything's fine. But let's back up a little bit. So Morpheus, Neo, and the Keymaker enter into the back door, and they find that it is filled with dozens and dozens of Smiths. And there's a fight that ensues. And this fight matters. We're close to seeing what the source is, and we're kind of jacked up about it. Smith tries to do his sort of copying on Morpheus, but Neo saves him. The Keymaker gets away and uses his keys and vanishes into one of the doorways. So it's really Morpheus and Neo fighting all these Smiths. Finally, a door opens at the end of the hallway, and the Keymaker beckons the two of them, and Neo grabs Morpheus, and they fly into the door. As the Keymaker is closing the door, dozens of Smiths all pull their weapons and spray the doorway with bullets. The Keymaker closes the door, turns around. He's been hit fatally, falls to the ground. He gives Neo a key. He says, one of these doors will lead you to the source. And he gives Neo the key and says, you'll know which door. The other door leads back to the Matrix, which is for Morpheus to go back. Trinity has done her deal. She's taken care of the backup power system. She's now entered into Neo's vision. And now Neo faces the source. It's a really exciting piece of the film. Neo walks in and he faces the architect. And we're given some incredible information. We're given some information. The Matrix is actually older than even Neo realizes. There have been six previous The Ones. Zion has actually been destroyed six previous times. And the architect tells Neo they've become increasingly efficient at destroying it. So an incredibly elevated language. The beginning of the architect's explanation harkens back to Smith talking to Morpheus when he was interrogating him in the first film, talking about how the first Matrix was a utopia and how terrible of a failure it was. The architect starts there and says whole crops were lost, and now the Matrix had to be designed with a certain sense of flaw inherently built into it. And yet, the architect knows that the flaws built into each Matrix will eventually become systemic, and things will have to be sort of re-wiped and started over again. And the flaw is expressed by Neo. What I think the Wachowskis are getting at, and what I think the architect's explanation is, the world needs to exist in a certain sense with a sort of oppressed masses hero story. And I think what the architect is saying is the human world works best when there is oppression and the world is set up to where, you know, most people have to struggle. But there is this sort of hope. There is this hope and there is this prophecy and there is actually this being called the One that comes around once in a while. And this mythology, in a sense, is the what he calls the inherent flaw in the Matrix. And of course, what I think he's explaining is that in every version of the Matrix, once the One becomes conscious and the flaw expresses itself, it quickly starts to manifest, meaning lots more people jack out. In a sense, the resistance grows and grows and grows. But it's this cycle of rebellion and this is why I think that the ideas and the themes in this movie are brilliant. Because what the architect is saying and how subversive this is that human society is best designed with a sort of oppressive rule and rebellious hope designed into it in order to give it stability, and that humans' hope to be relieved from oppression actually stabilizes the system. And the machines had to learn that. When they tried to make a system perfect, it completely failed and crashed, and none of the human beings would believe it. But given humanity a choice to accept the oppression of the Matrix world and the hero's journey or chosen one prophecy mythos, that they accepted. What Neo is slowly comprehending, I don't know that he fully comprehends it in this moment, is that he is just another part of the machine. It's another system of control. If you're into religious studies, you can take this and run with it, because the Wachowskis are postulating that, you know, religious doctrine and religion in general is another method of control to keep the masses sort of... It was a great phrase by, I think, Upton Sinclair, that when something like promise of the world to come was so great, you know, that kept them busy, people busy, while their pockets were picked in this life. And I think that's what's so subversive about this whole idea. The architect is saying, hey, the world works when we oppress most of you and give you this hope for complete redemption. And in that way, your world becomes stable. I think that is fantastic. Now we're back. The architect says, look, you have two choices. You can take a certain amount of males and females, start a brand new Zion, let us destroy the old one, we'll reset the Matrix, and on we go. Or you can try to save Trinity, although, you know, the architect says we both know that that's a lost cause. And if you go to save her, he says the systemic, you know, anomaly and the problems of the Matrix, the Matrix is going to crash and be destroyed, and most of humanity will die that's connected to the Matrix. And you're all going to die in Zion because we're going to kill you. Neo says, you know, if you kill us, you're dead too. And the architect says, well, there are levels of existence we're prepared to deal with. Basically saying, you know, this is a classic standoff. Now the architect's saying, look, you're all going to die if you don't do what I tell you to do. And Neo says, well, you'll all die too. And the architect's like, no, we won't. It won't be pretty for us, but we'll manage. So that's kind of Neo's choice. And of course, Neo chooses to save Trinity and to go against the surefire and the systemic thing that the Architect has created. He chooses not to continue the systemic lie that's being perpetrated on his race. So now we're in the last moments. We see Trinity get hit. Neo leaves the Architect and flies at top speed and rescues Trinity, and he grabs her, and he reaches his hand inside her body because, you know, he can see the Matrix for what it is. He has sort of power over the Matrix itself. So he reaches into her body and pulls out the bullet, and through some power that he possesses as the One, restarts her heart and saves her. And she is quite alive, and they both jack out of the Matrix safe. So now there's this moment where Neo has to tell Morpheus. Remember, Morpheus is the prophet. And now the One has to go back to the prophet and basically say, no, it was all a lie. It was another method of control. And again, I think this is such a cool idea for a multi-million dollar Hollywood spectacle to have this subversive idea of control buried in it. It's one of the coolest things in the world. Morpheus gets the bad news. Then the Sentinels threaten and, to kind of skip back, because I'm doing this a little more out of sequence, the Vigilant, which is the group in the hovercraft that failed to destroy the backup power station, were destroyed by what the Sentinels have sort of learned about the EMP pulses that are deployed against them. So what they do is they stay just out of EMP range and they fling a bomb into range, hoping that the humans will trigger their EMP, rendering them, you know, inert, and then the Sentinels will swoop in. And if they don't trigger the EMP, the bomb that's thrown in will blow them up. So it's like, in a sense, the hovercrafts are kind of powerless against this. Well, the Vigilant was destroyed because it didn't understand. Neo senses it immediately and recognizes it and tells them that they have to leave the Nebuchadnezzar. They leave the ship, the bomb impacts, explodes, and now they're alone on foot in these tunnels, and the Sentinels are coming for them. And they're running, and Neo's like, we're not going to make it. And, you know, Trinity is like, we have to try. And at some point, Neo says, wait a minute, something's changed. I can feel them. So he stops and turns, and all these Sentinels sort of come upon them, and Neo puts his hand up, and he stops them all, electrocutes them all, and they all drop and fall to the ground. Very similar climactically to the moment in the Matrix when he made the bullet stop. This time it's Sentinels. Seemingly, the power to do such a thing has completely overwhelmed him and he drops. And now we cut to some discussion about the counterattack that the humans had planned. So part of the reason why all the ships were recalled to Zion is they wanted to send the ships out to intercept the Sentinels before they got too close to Zion. All the ships would intercept, trigger their EMPs to try to stop the diggers. Now we're getting the information that something happened. Someone triggered an EMP pulse too soon. You know, most of the hovercrafts were knocked out. The rest of them were destroyed. So all of the hovercrafts have been destroyed by the Sentinels. The only one that's left is the Logos, basically. And I believe one other. And we end this film with, you know, Neo unconscious. We don't know what's the deal with him. But as we're hearing that story about the failed counterattack, the captain of the ship that they're on says, well, there's one person who might know, but he hasn't said anything yet. And when he wakes up, he's going to have to answer a lot of questions. And so the camera pans from Neo's chest to his head and then continues. And laying sort of in a mirror opposite him, which, you know, thematically resonates between Neo and Smith, is Bane. And Bane, you know, as a viewer, we realize that Smith being in Bane's body probably triggered the EMP pulse and screwed everything up. At the moment, he's unconscious, and we now leave Neo and Bane, and we cut out. And that ends The Matrix Reloaded. Brief recap for Reloaded. The themes in this movie that are talked about, I really enjoy the idea of taking philosophical themes and sprinkling them throughout the movie. Causality for the Merovingian, purpose for Neo and Smith. When Neo talks to the senator, they talk about control. It's a great idea. It's a really neat idea. The subversion of sort of the prophecy, the chosen one mythos, one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen done. So thematically, I'm really on board. I walked away from this movie with the themes really ringing in my head, but the execution of the film to me was an extreme letdown. I really, really was not in the film the way I was in the first Matrix. There were so many things just on a level of film craft that I felt they were moving into more cliched territory. They were less interesting. They were doing things that had been done before. When they opened up the scope of the movie, they were bringing in a lot of cliched type of film techniques that we've seen 1,000 times before. And for me, as a viewer, it did not resonate with me, especially being so blown away by the first film. To have them then go in a more sort of traditionalist epic framework, it was a big letdown, you know, in terms of how a film works and plot, writing, and character. That said, the themes, like I said before, really, really amazing. So now we will set ourselves up for the final movie, which will be The Matrix Revolutions, which I'm going to cover in my next podcast. So thanks for listening. This is Sci-Fi on Screen, and I'll see you next time.